The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
I want you to judge a case. I'm going to give you a case. It's a true story. And I want you to be the judges. But in order to be the judges of the case, first you have to know the legal ramification. So we have to take a look at our next issue for the day, which I have to tell you is very strange. Okay? We discussed, we introduced the commandments. And then we introduced the Ten Commandments. And then we began the first commandment, is it a commandment, is it not? Right? Belief in God. And then we did the second commandment, did it. We touched upon it, idolatry. And now we're up to number three. Now, till now, we've been dealing with very major issues. Very major issues. Is there a God? Is there not a God? Getting rid of idols. What are idols? Who do I really serve? Now we get to number three, and number three seems to be so innocuous, so inconclusive, so tangential, that one begins to wonder what the real issue is. Check out verse 7. Lo tisa'at shem Hashem Elokecha lashav. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Whatever that means. Ki lo yinakeh Hashem et asher yisa'at shmo lashav. Because God will not hold guiltless. It's a very strange term, yinakeh. The nakot is to clean, right? Naki michet is to be clean of sin. God's not going to clean up your mess if you do this. Now, till now, we haven't had this problem. God says, I am the Lord thy God. That's it, that's the commandment. God says, don't believe in idols. Don't believe in idols. All of a sudden, God's starting to philosophize. If you do this one, I'm not going to clean up your mess. So maybe we'll get to that. If we don't get to it, it should bother you. But now I want to figure out, what is the commandment here? What is this? Lo tisa'at shem Hashem Elokecha lashav. Thou shalt not take the name of thy God in vain. So now listen to the following case. And tell me, you are now the court. Court is in session. The Torah is very clear. You can't take God's name in vain. I don't know where you'd want to take it. Maybe you want to leave it. Maybe you want to keep it. But whatever that means. We all have an image. Does everybody here have an image of what they think that means? Right? Right? Okay. This guy's name, Shmuel, very interesting fellow. He taught me about a totally different type of kashrut, totally different type of dietary law. We were, and I'd already sort of been aware of his views, without getting into politics and without becoming stereotypical. We were in Ramallah. This is like deep, deep into the Intifada. And I already had been doing reserve duty for a few years, and I knew the guys that I was, and I was already sort of comfortable as being an officer. And we were doing patrols, foot and jeep, in a place called, I think it was El Amari, Calandia, different refugee camps that are in Ramallah. And every night, people from the yeshuvim, from the settlements, that were in the area, would do an incredible thing. And it was clearly motivated. Some of them were motivated just with the opportunity to do a mitzvah, and some of them were politically motivated, and pro or con, whatever, it was still a beautiful thing to do. Whenever they would drive by the patrols or the roadblocks, or whatever, they would stop, and they would give the soldiers like cake, or pitot, or cookies, or hot coffee, or things like that. And ostensibly, it was an act of appreciation. Because after all, these soldiers were there to protect those settlements. And they wanted to show them that they were appreciative of what they were doing. Some people viewed it as a political act. In other words, they were trying to win the hearts and minds of the Israelis who were coming from all over the country to the settlements to sort of get them to appreciate the people who lived in the settlements. Perhaps it was a mixture of both. There was a lot going on politically at the time. Should we give back portions of Judea and Samaria? Should we not? They wanted perhaps to show people that they were human beings. Okay. So this particular fellow, Shmuel, had very left-wing opinions. I remember this one particular night, and there were a group of us standing. We were on a jeep patrol, but we'd stopped by a roadblock just to talk to the soldiers there. And this car pulls up. I was going to Psagot, which is an area, a settlement just outside of Ramallah. And he had been in town, and he had gone to a shawarma place. You know what shawarma is? Right? Like meat, like, don't think about it too much because you won't concentrate on my class, shawarma, right? So he brought like seven or eight shawarmas. like little pita steak sandwiches. And when he opened his window, the smell of them hit us. And he said, oh, chevre bo kru, you know, guys, come, take, help yourself, whatever. Right? You know, no big deal, a couple, a few shekels a piece, whatever. So this Shmuel says, lo, lo, ze lo kasher, it's not kosher. Now he was very Sephardic, right? Very of Middle Eastern descent. And in Israel, it's an interesting phenomenon that sometimes people, you know me already, people who call themselves not religious, nonetheless, will very often have certain traditional values. So you could meet a guy who might drive on Shabbat, but who feels very strongly about eating unkosher food, and vice versa. So I thought that he was saying, like, you know, well, you know, even though I do whatever I do, and even though I'll smoke kashrut, you know, I won't eat unkosher food. And that's not uncommon. So I said to him, no, you don't have to worry. He said, psychot, I know the settlement, I'm sure, I see the guy, keep up. I'm sure you don't have to worry about the kashrut. I'm sure it's kosher. But I'll ask him. He goes, no, for me it's not kosher. I said, I'm telling you, the kashrut, you know, you don't have to worry. I'm eating it. I'm a rabbi, don't worry. No, for me it's not kosher. Why? Because it's right-wing food. I won't eat food that's given to me by people who live over the green line. Now you could imagine. You could imagine. I said, okay, I'll take your shawarma. You know, fine. As an altruistic, selfless act, you know, so that the person giving it wouldn't feel bad, because I'm that kind of guy. Okay. So you could imagine, you know, you're on a patrol. You don't have tremendous amounts of things to do at, 1 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday night. So we got into a long discussion, which delved and covered everything in Judaism that you could imagine. I mean, belief in God, divinity of Torah, value of Judaism, politics, everything. And this guy believed he was an avowed atheist. There is no God. God is dead, whatever. 10 minutes later, he was an avowed agnostic, okay? Because it's hard to know that God doesn't exist. So we had long discussions about this. Didn't believe in God, convinced God didn't exist, etc. About 2.5 weeks later, we were in northern Ramallah, and we came under fire. And it was a very serious situation, and thank God, you know, we all got out of it okay, and the whole story is not for now, because then we'll really never get to class. But this guy was one of the guys who was called in, and we came under fire, and we're not even sure if somebody was actually firing a gun, but they were throwing things that were unbelievable. They were throwing blocks, and some guy in a building took a cinder block, and was throwing cinder blocks, and there were four of us that were sort of trapped, and there was a mob. It was not a pleasant story, right? And this guy is there, and what is he doing? This guy had been through the Yom Kippur War. Elohim, 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 Elohim! Oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God! Right? So now, I learned very early on in officer's course that one of the things you can do when people are, the worst thing that you can do is allow your soldiers to remain under tremendous pressure. It's not good. If you can somehow pull the pressure off, then they function better as soldiers. So I said, don't you mean, Lo Elohim, Lo Elohim, Lo Elohim, Lo Elohim, right? No God, no God, no God, no God. So he kind of grinned at me, and afterwards we had a discussion about it. Now, I have an interesting question for you. Was this guy violating this commandment? He doesn't believe in God. He's convinced there's no God. He's in a situation. So he's screaming God. But he doesn't, you know, by the time the situation is over, and I ask him what it is, well, you know, it's instinct, and that's what you hear, and I'm not thinking about God. Whatever. You can imagine, we had an interesting discussion. We had a couple of Kalbach stories rolling around, you know. Anyway, so, is he taking God's name in vain? I mean, if I'm going to say God's name, so I can appreciate this commandment. What it's telling me is, you know, if you're married, and you develop a relationship with your wife, and it's a deep relationship, learn to mean what you say. Learn to consider the value of what you're saying. When I say to my wife or my children, I love you, I mean it. I don't just say it. You know, we're kids, so we run out the door. Bye, Mom, love you, slam the door. Do we really mean what we're saying? Are we really saying, oh, Mother, who brought me into this world, who stayed up endless nights from 2 to 4 in the morning, nursing me and diapering me and putting up with all my nonsense until I was old enough to give you more nonsense, etc. Oh, Mother, do I appreciate that everything I am and all that I can be, everything, is a part of you. And that no matter what you do to me, I can never really repay you. And that who I am, I gain so much from you. Is that what I mean? Or do I mean, listen, I want to leave, and I don't want to have a discussion. I know that the love you gets me out the door, so I'm covered for the day. Not such a good thing. So maybe what it's saying is, with your relationship with God, don't take God's name in vain. If you're going to talk to God, mean it. If you don't mean it, don't talk to God. Don't say, oh God. Right? A guy walks in, trips over the stairs, says, God damn it! So he violated the commandment. Or is he really asking God to curse that stone for having affected him in such a negative way? So do you think that this guy violated this commandment? Just let's have a show of hands. Who is convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that this guy definitely messed up somehow? Is he going to hell? I don't know. But somehow, if he'd read this right before he said that, he would have thought twice about it. Anybody here convinced of that? No. Is there anybody convinced that he did not? You are. Okay. Is there anybody here who, one second, who is convinced that this commandment has nothing to do with it? Nobody. You are. Okay. So everybody else, I guess, is somewhere in the middle. You're not sure. You could see this being related to this commandment. Now, you wanted to say something. Okay, now forget the punishment for the moment, because we don't even know what punishment means. So let's put punishment aside, right? But you're saying that this could theoretically mean that if I'm saying God's name in a negative way, or I'm using God's name, that's what he's doing, right? He's using God's name, right? It's like, let's say I gave a class on mezuzah, right? That scroll that's on the doorpost, right? And at the end of the class, you know, the whole thing was interesting. But at the end of the class, I said, you know, that people who go out and kiss the mezuzah, so it's assured that they will find, I don't know, they'll find love in their life. I never read that anywhere, never heard of it, but it sounds like a nice idea, right? So I said, from then on, somebody kisses the mezuzah every day. So are they really appreciating the mezuzah? So you could argue both sides of the coin. You could say by virtue of kissing the mezuzah every day, maybe eventually they'll come to think, well, why am I doing this and what does it mean? But until then, you could argue, well, okay, they're just using the mezuzah. That's not really what it is. So maybe this person's using God's name. On the other hand, maybe there's something deep in there. Now my real question is, this isn't the Ten Commandments. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's an interesting discussion. This is up there with don't worship idols. I mean, we're going to get to don't murder and don't steal and don't adulter. And before that, don't curse God in the shower. That's important. So we have to understand what this commandment is. What does this mean? And I want you to know, it's very interesting because the Talmud makes it even more difficult. Does anybody know what particular action tradition tells me this commandment is speaking of? That you're not supposed to do. There's something you're not supposed to do. A false... Good. False vows. False oaths. You're not supposed to take God's name in vain. You don't swear. You've got this look like, what? No? Right? I agree with you. It's crazy, right? You've got... You're not supposed to swear falsely in God's name. Now, before we go on, I have to explain to you what that means. We're going to have to figure this out. But the Talmud tells me that there are four types of oaths. Vain oaths. By the way, what we're not talking about a false oath for profit. We're not talking about a case where there's a case known as an obligation of an oath. In other words, it's called modeh. I'll give you one example. It's called modeh b'miktzat, right? If I admit partially. Let's say that, Ezra comes to me and says, listen, you owe me $100. And I say to him, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have $100. I never got $100. Have a nice day. So he's claiming that I owe him money. I'm completely denying it. So the burden of proof is on him. If you want to remove property from someone, the evidence falls on him. You have to prove me. Why should otherwise everybody would go claiming, right? But there's an interesting dilemma. What if he comes to me and he says, you owe me $100? And I say, look, it's true. I borrowed $100 from you. I did borrow $100 from you. I paid you back 50 already. I only owe you 50. Now what have I done? I've admitted already that such a transaction existed. So the Talmud says, in that case, if I want not to have to pay the other 50, if I want not to have to pay, I agree I owe him 50. If I want to pay him only 50 and not 100, I have to swear an oath. Why? Because if a guy comes and lends you $100, so it's not so difficult to say, no, I agree with you, I know, but you forgot, I paid you back part of it. But to have the chutzpah to tell a guy, I never borrowed money from you, the average person wouldn't have such a chutzpah. He wouldn't be so audacious. So therefore, we suspect that the person really might owe $100. So therefore, he has to give an oath. That's an oath for profit. And if I lie, and I swear by God's name that I only owe him $50, so I'm swearing falsely for profit, you might think that that's what this is about. And there are all sorts of other oaths for profit, right, for money. No. That's, as a matter of fact, in a different place. It's in Leviticus, right, chapter 19, verse 12. Velo tishavu vishmi lashakir, and you shall not swear in my name vainly. V'chilalta shem elokecha ani Hashem. You will therefore, by, if you do that, you will sort of l'chalel, you will profane, you will make chol. Chol is the weekday, Shabbat is elevated, you will desanctify, desecrate my name. This verse refers to a false oath for profit. So that can't be what the Ten Commandments is talking about. So what's the Ten Commandments talking about? So the Talmud says, the Ten Commandments is talking about when I swear an oath in vain, what's called shvuat shav. It's not the same as shvuat sheker. It's not the same as a false oath. It's a vain oath. And the Talmud tells me there are four types of vain oaths. Okay? The most obvious is if I swear to you, okay, that this is Tuborg beer, right? That this is, I don't know, Chivas Regal 24-year brand. So you look at this, and you know that it's just not true. If I tell you that the table is gold, so you know it's not true. So that's not a false oath. That's an oath which has no purpose. It's a waste. I'm taking God's name for no purpose. If I swear to you that this is a cup of coffee, so I'm telling the truth. But that's also a vain oath. Because I don't need to swear that it's a cup of coffee. You know it's a cup of coffee. So I'm bandying about God's name for no purpose. If I swear to you, right, that I want to violate one of God's commandments. It's an interesting question. I swear that I'm not going to keep Shabbat. I don't know, fulfill Shabbat. It's one thing if you don't. It's one thing if you swear you're not. I swear I'm going to have pig every day for the rest of my life. So I can't swear to do something which I'm not allowed to do. So therefore, right, to swear in God's name that I'm going to do something which God tells me I can't do. Again, my perspective, right, traditional perspective. So that's a problem because I've sworn somehow at Sinai that I'm going to fulfill the commandments through my ancestors. So that's a false oath. And the fourth is if I swear that I'm going to do something that I can't possibly physically do. I swear I'm not going to sleep for 2 weeks. So I'm not. It's not physically possible for me not to sleep for 2 weeks. So I've taken God's name in vain. That's what the Talmud says. Very difficult. What's obviously difficult? Before you ask a question. What's obviously difficult? What bothers me about this being this commandment? Swearing a vain oath. Yeah. What is this doing in the Ten Commandments? Why is this important to me? I mean, do you see that? If my original assumption is correct, that these commandments are crucial, they're the essence, they're the introduction to all of Judaism, why is this so important? So this is what I want to understand today. Now you want to ask something. Since you mentioned that, we're going to get to that. We have to take a good linguistic look at this pasuk. Okay, which is exactly where I want to go. If this is what this commandment is, as the Talmud seems to imply, and you are now considering how to state this commandment, what would you say? It's in English. Right? Based on what I've just said, that the commandment may well imply, how would you phrase that commandment? Thou shalt not swear an oath in vain. For no reason, whatever that means, right? That's what you should see. But that's not what the pasuk says. That's not at all what the verse says. What does the verse say? Look at the verse. Lo tisa et shem Hashem elokecha lashav. Thou shalt not carry the name of God in vain. Now what does that mean? There's a portion of the week in Exodus, which we will read in a few more weeks. It's called Kitisa. Kitisa. It's a very difficult portion, because it deals with the sin of the golden calf, but it's called Kitisa, because the beginning of that portion says, right, Kitisa et Rosh Bnei Israel, when you will count each Jew, and it tells me that I'm supposed to undertake a census, how I do it, how I don't do it, I don't count each individual Jew, right? I collect from each Jew a half a shekel, and I count the half shekels. Now that seems like a very silly little game, but the Torah is making a very valuable point. People are not numbers. People are not numbers. It's almost the antithesis of what the Nazis tried to do. They tried to turn human beings into numbers. King David, in the book of Samuel, suffered a plague because he counted his soldiers. We don't count people. How could you ever count a person? How could you ever look at a person as a number? How could you ever look at a group and say each one person is a part of a number? As a matter of fact, probably Rabbi Schoenbach will get to this, or I will, but if not, the concept of a quorum. When a tenth man walks into a minyan, question of why men and not women, that's a good question, question and answer session. But when a tenth man walks into a room, and all of a sudden there are certain things that I can do that I couldn't do before, that somehow the community is different from the individuals, that tenth man is not just a number ten. He fundamentally changes the nature of the whole group. People are not numbers. So what does that tell me? Tisa can mean to count, to carry, when you want to carry with you the number. Right? When God tells Moses to tell the priests how to put together and undo the tabernacle, which was the precursor of the temple in the desert. So he says, Laseit et Aron Hashem, to carry the Ark of Covenant of God. So what is Lo Tisat Shem Hashem Elokeinu Lashav? That you can't carry God's name in vain. So you've figured out who I am and what I'm going to do with this. We have to get into this and see what this is. That's my first question. So now that's my second question. So now I've got two questions. First of all, I want to understand the relevance of this commandment. And second of all, I want to understand the language. And that brings me to the third issue, which is what Leo was mentioning. If I look in this commandment, what's the word here? The word is lashav. Okay? The word lashav is a very interesting word. Shaveh, in modern Hebrew, means equals. Right? Equality. Equality is a term which is very much abused in our society. I'll give you an example. The Equal Rights Movement. The Equal Rights Amendment. Equality for women. Now, don't get me wrong. The ERA movement in America, which demanded equal rights for women, did tremendous things. And I think it affected certain changes in our psyche as a world, by the way, not just as a Western society, which are tremendously valuable. And I'm not just talking about the technical issues, such as women getting the vote, and, you know, women attempting. We're not nearly there yet, not even in America, and certainly not in the rest of the world. But women attempting to gain equality in the workplace, and all sorts of other perceptions. But the movement did a certain, I think, it allowed a certain misperception to inculcate its way into our psyche. You see, men and women are not equal. Equal means that two things are exactly the same. Two equals two. And one plus one equals two, because one plus one is two. This table is equal to this table. They're the same. They fulfill the same function. They're built the same way. They look almost identical. And if I took you out of the room and switched them around, you wouldn't know. So men and women are not equal. We're very different. It doesn't mean we don't deserve the same rights. It doesn't mean we shouldn't be treated in a certain fashion exactly the same. But it doesn't mean that we're equal. Right? African Americans, Native Americans, white Americans, you know, they're still waiting to figure that one out. Like, I grew up that the term Negro was a very negative term. You know, until I was 10 years old, I lived on 125th in Amsterdam. So I heard all sorts of terms. Right? So when I was brought up, so my parents made it very clear to me that you didn't call such a person a Negro, you called him a black. Then, at a certain point, black is no longer acceptable, it's now African American, which is legitimate. And Indian is no longer acceptable, and that really makes a lot of sense to me, because India was a total misnomer, so you have Native American. But of course, then the question is, well, what about white American? Well, so you really don't have any white Americans, you have Italian Americans, and Greek Americans, and Polish Americans, etc., but there's all sorts of people who aren't sure what kind of Americans they are, so they call themselves white Americans. So why white American is okay and black American is not is an interesting question. And we get too stuck on terms. And I think this is part of the same question of equality. We're not equal. We're very different. We look different. We have different cultural backgrounds. We have different heights and shapes and sizes and psyches, etc. So that's the word shaveh. Shav is very closely related to shaveh. You don't find the word shaveh in the Bible. Because shaveh as equal is an illusion. Remember I told you the other day, if a word is nowhere to be found, it's because it's our creation, it's an illusion. These tables aren't equal. We may perceive them as equal. They're from two different trees. And they're two different tables. This is equal to this, because it is this. But this is not equal to this. And if one of them didn't work, you would see that they're not equal. I'm right-handed. So God forbid, if I couldn't use my hand one day, there'd be a big difference between whether it be this hand or this hand. And nothing in the world is really equal. So what's shav? What does that mean? What does it mean that you can't take God's name in vain? And I think, by the way, understanding this term, this shavut, is going to be crucial to understanding this commandment. So let's, for the moment, put that aside, because we have to figure that out. If we figure out what the word shav means, that you can't take God's name in shav, then we'll figure out what the commandment is. Now let's go a stage further. And now I'm going to give you a little inkling as to how, you know, we're studying a commandment. So there are different things that we can do to try to figure out what the commandment is. So I told you that there's an ethical perception and a symbolic perception and a mystical perception. It's very hard to imagine a symbolic perception here. What is the symbolism of a person taking an oath? That is the commandment. And we don't really have symbols in the nature of, let's say, kashrut or shabbat or things like that. So it's a little difficult. Perhaps we have to figure out the ethical and the mystical perspective. But I want to give you now another way of analyzing a mitzvah. And this, I will grant you, is a little more difficult. It's a little more difficult, first of all, because without background, it becomes more difficult to find. But it's not so difficult as you imagine. And I'm more interested in you being aware of the process than of you actually being able to put the process to work right now. Because I've met tons of people who've been in the system, as it were, whether in yeshiva or studying, whatever, for a long time, who weren't even aware that this was a part of the process. You know what you can do to analyze a mitzvah? You can do something which is completely backwards. Take a look at how tradition says I fulfill this mitzvah. When am I fulfilling it? And when am I transgressing it? If I find instances where I'm violating this mitzvah, then that will sometimes give me an inkling into understanding how this mitzvah works. Right? Now it seems like that's backwards. First I want to understand the mitzvah, and then I can learn, you know, what details apply to. But sometimes it's difficult. So sometimes you can do it backwards. Look at the details, at the fulfillment of a mitzvah. And by figuring out the fulfillment of the mitzvah, you will learn a lot about the mitzvah. I'll give you an example. There are whole discussions about prayer, the obligation of prayer, rabbinic obligation, biblical obligation, etc. And it's very clear, by the way, that not only do men have an obligation to pray, but women have an obligation as well. And the real question is what the nature of a woman's obligation to pray is, what the nature of a man's obligation to pray is. So Maimonides says quite clearly that a woman has an obligation to pray biblically every day. But it's interesting that when you look in some of the commentaries and some of the halachic authorities, how you fulfill such an obligation is fascinating. The Rama, Rav Moshe Isserles, who is one of the greatest authorities halachically in the Ashkenaz world in the last 500 years. He lived in the 1500s in Krakow. As a matter of fact, his synagogue, the Rama's synagogue, Rav Moshe Isserles was his name, is one of the only synagogues left standing in all of Poland, and it is one of two synagogues left standing, if I'm not mistaken, in Krakow. Survived the war. He built it actually in honor of his wife, in memory of his wife, and he wrote a code, a commentary on the code of Jewish law, which has become the father of all halachic rulings for the Ashkenaz, the Germanic, French, descended community, which is most of us in this room, but not all of us. He says a very interesting thing. He says that if a woman in the morning wakes up, washes her hands, you know, traditionally you wash your hands in the morning, just as you wash your hands before you eat bread, you're going to, you know, fulfill a mitzvah, you wash your hands, so your whole day is a mitzvah, so you wash your hands in the morning. So he says, if a woman, after she washes her hands, you know, just says the blessing of Nitilat Yadayim on the washing of her hands, she's fulfilled her obligation. If she just offers up a quick sentence to God, thank you for whatever, or please help me, whatever, that's her fulfillment of prayer. She doesn't have to get out the whole prayer book and do the whole thing. So that's fascinating. And from that comment, I can learn to understand the meaning of prayer. Because prayer is not about this. It's not about text. It's not about format. Prayer is about me developing a relationship with God. And that detail can clue me into that. So I can first study prayer and come to the conclusion that through prayer I develop a relationship with God. And then I can say, well, therefore, if a woman or a man, I'm using this example because this is the one that Ramah discusses, one of the reasons that a woman doesn't have the same level of obligation is because there were certain expectations of her. Or rather, I should say, there was less expectation of her because of her role within society and because of the fact that that a woman had certain limitations. And I'm giving you just enough to whet your appetite because I want you to ask me this question. The truth is that this halacha applies to men and women as well, to a certain extent. So first I can come to a conclusion that the essence of prayer is to develop a relationship with God. And from there I can say, okay, so then this detail is correct. Then it should be that a woman can do such a thing and fulfill her obligation. Or I can do the opposite. I can look at the detail, I can find it in the code of Jewish law, and then I can figure out what prayer means. So let me give you an example with regards to our commandment. Because this is very interesting. Suppose I want to drink this cup of coffee. From a traditional perspective, what do I have to do? I have to make a blessing. Okay? So, Baruch Atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, right? Blessed are thou, Lord of the Universe, who brings forth bread from the field. Hamotzi Lechem Min Haaretz. And then I drink the coffee. So what did I do wrong? Wrong blessing. But I blessed God, didn't I? I mean, that's a good thing, right? So let's say right now I'm not eating bread. I don't know, somebody walks over to me this afternoon at or Tuesday night at 10:30, right? Right after Rabbi Aaron's lecture. Or Rabbi Cordoza this week. Plug, 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 right? And walks over to me and says, boy, you give a great lecture. Now, you've met Rabbi Cordoza. If anybody would confuse the two of us, I would tell them to sit in the front row the next week, but you understand. So I would say to them, you know, well, I didn't give the lecture. Yeah, but so what? So maybe they're just telling me that I give a great lecture some other time. So I'm telling God, great, tremendous, you give us bread. Maybe I'm reminding myself how wonderful it is that God gives us bread. So I'm not doing anything wrong. That's not what the Talmud says. Talmud says, if you make the wrong blessing, you are violating, this is a Talmudic discussion in Brachot, I think it's on Folio 33, you're violating this commandment. And that's very severe. I mean, I think blessings are important, but now you're telling me if I don't get the right blessing, I'm messing up on one of the Ten Commandments. That's very difficult. How does that work? So from that detail, maybe we can gain an inkling of what this commandment is about. How could it be that I could make the wrong blessing, and I'm violating one of the Ten Commandments? What is this commandment? How is this commandment relevant? What does it mean? So now before we go on, I see a few of you have what to say. So go ahead. First of all, I agree with everything you say. I have one little problem. Just to repeat what you said, that you're saying that taking God's name in vain, etc., whatever that means, it has to do with my language and how I speak and the fact that everything I say on this world should be important, if I understood you correctly. And that's very, very true. And it's crucial. Except that I've got other commandments in the Torah that tell me that. Lo teilech rachil ba'amecha. You're not supposed to slander, right? You're not supposed to speak lashon hara. And that's very important. But it's not in the Ten Commandments. As a matter of fact, based on what you're saying, and I would think this anyway, how could lashon hara not be in the Ten Commandments? Now, you could argue, right? You could argue. I mentioned, and don't forget your comment, and don't forget your comment, right? I mentioned to you when we were introducing the Ten Commandments that there's an idea mystically that every part of the Torah is somehow to be alluded to in the Ten Commandments. So as a matter of fact, that's exactly where you find Lashon Hara in the Ten Commandments. This alludes to all things related to speech and therefore to Lashon Hara. Much as in the way, even more fascinating to me is the fact that there's an opinion that says that all the stories in the Bible are alluded to in the Ten Commandments. Like for example, like the first sin of Adam and Eve. So how could Adam eat the apple? Well, something was lacking in his understanding of Anochi Hashem Elokecha, of I am the Lord thy God. If he really understood constantly that God was there, and if he had that relationship constantly with God, God was right before him, then he couldn't have eaten from that fruit. Probably wasn't an apple. He couldn't have eaten from the fruit. So you find allusion to it. But I'm first looking for what the meat of it is. Yes?
I think that...
Right. That's very true. That's very true. If I come into a room and I say, I don't know, your mother wears army boots, so that may not be a nice thing to say in terms of speech, but it has nothing to do with this commandment, at least ostensibly. You know, beyond delusion. That's very true. We have to figure out what this means in terms of the name of God. You wanted to say something?
I think that if you mean the whole...
So I want to take what you say. What you're saying is that the name of God has to be on a certain pedestal. And I shouldn't make it mundane. Okay. Let's see where we can go from there. So now, let's think about this for a minute. What does this mean? To really understand what it means to take the name of God in vain, I first have to understand what the name of God means. Because what it really should say is that I shouldn't take God in vain. Why does it say to take the name of God in vain? Now, you could argue, I mean, understand this question. This is very deep. You could say, and you would be well within your reasons to say, and you're right to say this, but then I'll tell you why you're wrong, right? You could say, you can't really take God in vain, because God can't be vain. God is God. God's unlimited. I can't make God vain. And yet at the same time, that's really what I'm doing. Or is it? Perhaps what this verse is saying, okay? You know, there's a very powerful idea. And it's interesting because it's one of the most important obligations that we have. And people take it for granted very often. And that's the concept of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem. What does that mean? Kiddush Hashem is the sanctification of God's name. Whatever sanctification means. Chilul Hashem, as I mentioned before, is the de-sanctification, the profaning of God's name. Chol is the profane, is the weekday, is the less holy. There are certain things that I can do that sanctify the name of God, and there are certain things that I will do that will desecrate the name of God. And we've all seen examples of this in our life. If, for example, if I go out on the street with a kippah, and I behave in a certain fashion, that allows people to say, look how somebody who wears a kippah, someone who represents God almost, looks, right? So then, I've profaned the name of God. Because people associate me with God. Because I wear something that tells people, associate me with God. If I do the opposite, if I do something which elevates the name of God, then that's called sanctification of God's name. There are, by the way, three examples par excellence. There are three prohibitions. You know, we mentioned in passing the other day that if somebody comes along, somebody comes, walks into class here, and without getting into technicalities, it's not so simple as I make it sound, but nonetheless, somebody comes into class here with a piece of pork sandwich, pulls out a 38 Smith & Wesson, puts it to my head, and says, I want you to eat this pork sandwich. You know what my only question is? Do I make a blessing? I have, not only am I allowed to eat that pork sandwich because my life's in danger, right? But I have an obligation to eat that pork sandwich. Because I'm not allowed to give up my life for a pork sandwich. Somebody tells me to desecrate the Sabbath, right? Now that's a biggie, right? Or he'll blow my head off. I have to desecrate the Sabbath. I'm not just allowed to, I have to. As a matter of fact, the Talmud says, the verse says, V'chai behem, and you shall live by them. Better to desecrate one Sabbath and live to celebrate many more than to fulfill one more and lose the opportunity to fulfill many more. So that's logical, but there are three exceptions. What are these three exceptions? And it's interesting, by the way, that the Talmud tells me that the reason that the first temple was destroyed was because of the violation of these three exceptions. And they are idolatry, adultery, and murder. Someone comes to me and says, I'm going to blow your head off. Unless you blow Abby's head off, So Abbi will be relieved to know that I have to allow him to blow my hand off. Which makes sense. Talmud says, who says that my blood is redder than hers? Can't make of me a murderer. If somebody says, I'm going to blow your head off unless you sleep with that person's wife, or another woman that I'm not allowed to by biblical law have relations with, right? So I have to allow him to kill me. That's a little more difficult. And so I have this quick physical relationship. Doesn't mean anything to me. Doesn't mean anything to her. Neither of us want to do it. But I would think that, you know, have that physical relationship so that I can have many more real physical relationships with the right person in the right way. No. Talmud says, in that instance, better to die. And idolatry is the third. Now the question is why? And it's interesting that the phrase is not because I sanctified God. And there's a powerful story that is told. It wasn't enough for them just to kill you. They wanted you to take part in the process. And so first you had to take your clothes off. And you had to remove everything. And sometimes you even had to take off your hair. Your hair was more valuable than you were. And then you had to dig a ditch. And people knew what they were doing. But they were incapable of doing anything about it. And you know, we judge them, which is a very dangerous thing to do. There was a certain power to their faith that no matter what the Nazis did to them, they never lost it. And in this particular town, so the Dayan of this town asked the Nazi commandant for a last request. You know, it's customary for the condemned prisoner to receive one last request. So the Nazi was a little amused. He caught him on a good day. He said, what's your request? He said, I'd just like to lead my congregation in one blessing. So the Nazi thought this was cute. You know, he'd have a good story to tell that night when they were drinking their beer. So he said, okay. The guy says in a loud voice, Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu melech haolam, blessed art thou, O Lord our God, Shelo asani goy, who has not made me of the nations of the world. So the Nazi starts laughing. He says, you idiot. He says, if God had made you anything but a Jew, you wouldn't be dying right now. Answered the rabbi, if God divided the world into two groups, the murderers and the murdered, I'm glad that I'm among the murdered, because I wouldn't want to be one of the murderers. It's a very powerful idea. Now you hear that story, and that's a sanctification of God's name. That someone who believes in a God, that part of any religion, and by the way, the Talmud discusses quite clearly that the sanctification of God's name is not limited to Jews. As a matter of fact, if you go to Yad Vashem, Holocaust Museum, you will see that the entrance to Yad Vashem begins not with Jews, but with non-Jews. There is a special forest planted for the righteous among the nations. The Talmud in Avodah Zarah is very clear that a non-Jew also can gain the world to come. We don't have, you know, eternity in heaven reserved for Jews. Not at all. As a matter of fact, in certain ways, it's much easier for a non-Jew to get into the world to come than it is for a Jew. Anyone. Tibetan monk, Christian priest, Raoul Wallenberg, who because of who he is as a human being, creates a sanctification of God's name, fulfills this mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem, of fulfilling God's name. Very powerful idea. So the question is the same. Why is that a sanctification of God's name? It's a sanctification of God! Unless you stop to think about it. See, what does God's name mean? I can't affect God. I mean, God is everything. God is unlimited. So I can't affect God. I can't change God. But it's very interesting. God's name really means the perception of God. You know, when I was young, so my dad, I must have been, I don't know, 7 or 8, whatever it was. So my dad caught me lying. I don't even remember the story anymore. I think I took something and it was clear that I took it and he asked me and I fibbed about it, you know. And I'm just waiting for my kids to get to this stage. Like, my kids don't know that they can lie yet. Somehow they're going to learn. It's a shame, but they're going to learn. Right now, you know, I asked my daughter, did you do it? She just says yes, because that's the answer. Like, why would she think to lie? But at a certain point, she's going to know. So my dad did a very smart thing. The two of them, actually, my mother also. They took me to the mirror. They said to me, who do you see? So I said, okay, here we go. We're going to get the speech, whatever it is, right? Okay, I see Benny, right? Right? I'd learned already, you know. Don't play dumb because it doesn't get you anywhere. So I said, well, I want to tell you something. See, the Benny that you see in the mirror isn't the Benny of this morning. It's changed. Because everything you see from your perspective is who you are. But everything everybody else sees is how they perceive you. And that picture will always be the same, whether you get a different haircut, whether you grow taller or you grow fatter. But if you lose your name, it's very hard to get back. It's very true. My name is dependent on me, but it's really the perception that others have of me. There's a very interesting halakha. Let's say I have to go to the bathroom. And I pass by McDonald's. And let's say the McDonald's isn't kosher. Right? Used to be, I would just say, I pass by McDonald's. But now, in Israel, there's one or two kosher McDonald's. You should be careful because they're not all kosher. But there's one or two that are. So, okay, it's a non-kosher McDonald's. Right? So, I'm not supposed to go into the non-kosher McDonald's just to go to the bathroom or to get a cup of water. Because somebody else might see me and think that I'm ordering, I don't know, a cheeseburger. So who cares? Who cares what they think? They're wrong. No. It's very important. Because how I relate to my fellow human being is a function of how they perceive me. And if I want to be able to have a positive effect on other human beings, if I want to make the world an ethical place, it's not enough for me to be an ethical person. I have to give people the perception that I'm an ethical person. And even though that's not quite the same as being an ethical person, which is much more important, and even though there are many exceptions to this halakha, something which is an impediment to other people being able to perceive me as an ethical person is a problem. And I have to consider the implications of that. And this applies not just to me, but to God also. Because what is God's name? God's name is our perception of God. And something which has a negative effect on our perception of God is a problem. And every human being is a messenger of God when you think about it. Because we are created, says the Bible, in the image of God. And therefore, to a certain extent, the perception of God is a function of the perception of man. Now, that's a macro, because that's the whole world. Go into a semi-microcosm. The Jewish people. Let's say for the moment that the Jewish people, somehow, you know, we're called the people with the mark of Cain. It's an interesting phrase. What it comes from has a lot to do with different ideas, even in Christianity. But we are the people of the book. Somehow the Jewish people has always been perceived, at least by the Jewish people, as messengers of God. If that's how I view myself, it doesn't matter for the moment whether anybody else views me that way. And it doesn't matter whether I'm right or they're right. But if that's how I view myself, if my system is that I believe that this system of Judaism has the opportunity to spread a message directly from God, to make the world a better place, then that means that people's perceptions of God are somehow wrapped up in people's perceptions of me. And therefore, when I'm perceived as being unethical, it's not just me that it affects. It affects God. So you'll say, wait a second. I can't affect God. God is unaffectable. And that's true. But I can affect people's perception of God. And that's why we're not talking about God. We're talking about God's name. You know, it's an interesting thing. Is God the king of the world or not? Interesting question. What do you need to be king? You need a kingdom. If you have no kingdom, are you a king? It's an interesting question. Right? When King Richard the Lionhearted was captured, and he was held in prison, right? And ostensibly, if England had ruled him out, so was he a king anymore? Well, he was a king in name only. What about God? Well, God is king of the world. God rules the world. God masters the world. But you see, if the people of the world don't accept God, then that means that there's something missing in God as king. Now, that's a very powerful idea. It means that if I'm right and there's a God, big assumption, and if God created the world, big assumption, then God created the world in such a way that he allows me to to affect him or it. We have a partnership. And our perception of God somehow depends on us as well. So the concept of sanctifying God's name means that when I behave a certain way, people perceive God in a certain way. That's an awesome responsibility. It's also a tremendous opportunity. So if I choose to murder another human being to save my life, then essentially, that affects not only who I am, but how people perceive God. And that's true if I worship idols in order to save my life. Because ultimately that means that my life is more important than my relationship with God. So that affects people's image of God. Let me give you an interesting example. Okay? Yes?
So what you just said means that
Bingo. If the seventh commandment, right? Remember I said that the first relates to the sixth. And the second relates to the seventh. And the third relates to the eighth. So what's the eighth? Lo tignov, thou shalt not steal, if I'm not mistaken. So what that means is that I'm stealing someone's image of God. And by the way, think about today's society. Think about how many people there are who would love to discover a beautiful relationship. Any type of beautiful relationship. How much more so a beautiful relationship with God? But they have a legitimate problem. A very legitimate problem. You see, their image of what God is and who God is very much through those people that they perceive to represent messengers of God. If a great rabbi, that's a relative term, but if a great rabbi is accused of income tax fraud, it's not a question of that rabbi. It's a question of how that affects the entire rabbinate and how that affects ethical Judaism and how that affects the world. And how many people have I heard say, you know, I'll give you a great example. We have to take a break. I'll give you a great example. And then we'll continue this. Rav Kook has an unbelievable article. It's in Arpalei Torah. It's a tremendous idea. It's called Emunah Shehi Kfira, Kfira Shehi Emunah. Faith, which is heresy, heresy, which is faith. It's in Arpalei Torah, whatever, it doesn't matter. Rav Kook, by the way, was the first chief rabbi of Israel before it was a state. An incredible, incredible individual. Much of Rabbi Aaron's teachings and philosophy are based on Rav Kook. I grew up, I was nurtured on the philosophy of Rav Kook. Tremendous idea. Let's just think about it. What does the atheist say? The atheist denies the existence of God. He doesn't believe that there's a God. Okay. Or believes there's no God. There's something rooted deeply in the concept of atheism, which is really faith. It bespeaks a great faith in God. I remember reading this. What? That denying God is really an act of faith in God. Why? Because if the image of God that I'm presented with is an image which is tainted such that I say, if this is God, I'm not willing to accept God, then what I'm really saying is that if there's a God, God has to be better than that. And that's faith. And that's really what people are saying. People are saying, if this is the image that you're presenting me of what God is, then I don't want to buy into that. I'm not interested in that God. Because my God, if there is a God, is better than that. And that's very true. And therefore, any human being who behaves in an unethical manner affects people's opinion of human beings in general. And every person who seems to somehow represent a relationship with God, who acts in an unethical manner, affects people's perception of God. I want you to know, it is an awesome responsibility to teach Torah. It is. The Talmud has unbelievable statements. It says, you know, if you're a Talmud Chacham, if you're a Torah scholar, v'tefer bebigdo, and he has like a rip in his garment, mitchayev benafsho, he's worthy of death. Wow. I remember once I was sitting in the Beit Midrash, and we were studying, and the Mashgiach, the sort of spiritual advisor, tremendous Torah scholar, walks by, and he noticed that I had like a little rip in my pants or whatever. So he quotes to me this Talmud. Talmud, you know, Talmud Chacham, who has a rip in his garment, so he's worthy of death. That's a nice thing to hear, you know, on Monday afternoon. Rip in your garment, worthy of death, right? So, you know, I had a good relationship with him. He was a very special person. He was one of the few rabbis I had met of that stature in that time that you could actually go over and slap on the back and say hello to. Very, very powerful guy, Rav Fisher. And he said, you think I'm kidding? I said, I'm not kidding. He said, go back to your room and change. So I said to him, but I'm not a Talmud Chacham. I'm not a Torah scholar. I'm learning, I'm trying, I'm not a Torah scholar. He said to me, no, you don't get it. He said, the minute you walked in, you became a Torah scholar. Because the minute you walked in and sat down starting Torah, then there are people who haven't studied as much as you, by definition. And you now represent Torah. That's an unbelievable thing. You know, I told you the other day, you go back to America, you're going to be rabbis. That's it. You represent something. It's a tremendous idea. So don't get nervous. I'm not putting the burden of responsibility on you. But the idea was to me tremendous. So what does it mean, mitchayev benafsho, that you're worthy of your life? So this is the next stage. What does it mean that I am worthy of death, that I'm worthy of giving up my life? How do I understand that? And now I get back to this commandment. What does it mean to carry God's name in vain? So, let's take a 5-minute. So I'll just go through them again as an aside if anyone wants to pick them up. The four oaths that are considered a vain oath that the Talmud discusses are, firstly, to swear to contradict a clearly known fact, right? I swear that this table is gold. To swear to verify a clearly known fact, like I swear this table is a table. To swear to violate one of God's commandments, like I swear I'm not going to celebrate Shabbat, that's the third. And the fourth is to swear to do what I obviously can't do, such as not to sleep. Those are the four. Okay? Got it? Right, I mentioned them, but they may have become confused. Okay. So now let's get back to where we were. So what does that mean? That I carry this name. And how do I understand Lo tisa et shem Hashem Elokecha lashav? Now I can begin to appreciate this commandment. You see, the name of God is not something that you choose to take or not to take. When you start to think about it, it's something you carry with you. Who are you really? Who are we? If there's a God, and as we hopefully develop a relationship with God, you begin to discover that you are very much a part of that God. And that ultimately all that you do carries the name of God. Comes the Torah and tells me, Lo tisa et shem Hashem Elokecha lashav. Don't carry that name in vain. It's interesting. I would have thought that it would be much more important to say, don't falsely swear. That's not what it says. It says vain. Why? If I'm a living reflection on the name of God, then the ultimate question is that living reflection in vain, or does it have purpose? Every part of my being, with everything that I do. If I wake up in the morning, and my life has meaning, and my life has purpose, and I make the world a better place, then the name of God that I carry deep within me isn't in vain. It has purpose. And every time I miss that, then somehow the name of God, the potential for how that affects everyone's perception, is in vain. I'll give you an example. You know, most of the things in life are really a function of how we appreciate them and whether we stop to really think about them. In fact, one of the central ideas of prayer really is doing just that, is stopping to think about the things that you already really know. It's the middle of the night. And that age-old debate is going on between your head and your toe. Because you want to get a glass of water. And the lights are out. And your head, to quote Bill Cosby, is saying, I can do this. I know the way to the bathroom. No problem. And your toe is saying, don't do this again. Don't do this to me. Turn on the light. And the head wins, and the toe gets smashed. And what happens? Right? Well, God darn it! Now, what does that mean? It's almost insignificant. It's a reflex. But I just lost an opportunity. Because what's this for? Or was it given it to me? It's a gift. It's an unbelievable gift. With incredible potential. To do so much good. Do you know how much good you can do with one word? With one smile? Do you know what potential there is for your relating to a fellow human being? Simply with this, with our mouths. It's a gift. It's a tool. It's not an end. It's not an objective. It's a means. It's a subject. And the real challenge is, what do I do with it? So if I stand up on a platform and I spread hatred, then I've abused the gift that God's given me. And essentially, if I'm created in the image of God, if I as a human being carry the name of God, then I've taken the name of God in vain. And if I use that gift to spread love, then I've fulfilled the name of God. You see, the first commandment is that there is a God, and that I can relate to God. And the second commandment is that I have to realize that if I want to develop a relationship with God, I have to let go of certain other distractions and idols and whatever they are. But those two commandments, they allow me the ability to develop a relationship with God. But I'm not there yet. What do I do with that? What do I do with that? That's the third commandment. Don't take it in vain. Because it's an incredible, incredible opportunity. You know, in a way, coming to a program like this, when you think about it, is a very difficult thing. Because, you know, ignorance is bliss. I mean, it is. You know, you sit back and you don't know. You don't know what it could be. You don't know what you're missing. Sometimes think that a person who's had a special relationship, it must be much, much more difficult. Because if you haven't had that relationship, if you've never been in love, then you don't maybe spend your days wishing you could be. But once you've discovered that love, once you know what it's like to be in love, then without that, you almost can't go on. And the same is true. Once you sense, you know, the beauty of, I don't know, Shabbat, so now, you realize what a gift it is. What do you do with it? Do you take it for granted? Or do you do something with it? And I don't want anybody here to misunderstand me. It's not, God forbid, for me to say. But I imagine that the average human being thinks about that. It's a real challenge. What do you do with it? It's like the average person says there's a mitzvah to have children. It's a wonderful, wonderful mitzvah. It's a wonderful mitzvah. If you don't have children, I imagine you can't really fully appreciate the value of that mitzvah. But once you have children, then you understand the mitzvah. So people think, you know, technically speaking, once, biblically speaking, the mitzvah is to have a child of each sex, right? A girl and a boy. Rabbinically, two girls and two boys, right? Covering the bases, right? So we had a daughter and then we had a son. So of course, biblically, I had fulfilled the commandment. But of course, I hadn't even begun. Once you have that gift, you know what the saddest thing is? The saddest thing is not to see someone who has no children. The saddest thing is to see someone who has children and doesn't realize it. I mean, how many of us know people, they have children, but they're so busy. They wake up early in the morning and they work till late at night and they have this to do and that to do and this meeting and that to do. And they never listen to their children. It's a real challenge. Could you imagine having a child and not spending time with a child? Could you imagine? People do it all the time. It's a gift. If you have a child and you don't find a way to be the parent to that child, then you're taking that child in vain. That's what you're doing. If you have an idea. So some people, they never have ideas. I don't imagine whether there are people like that that exist, but let's say. So if you don't have an idea, okay. Maybe you realize what it's like to have an idea and you want to have an idea. But if you have a great idea and you don't do anything with it, so you're taking the idea in vain. So I went home last night, and this is already a tradition with me. I get home, what do? I sit down at my computer, and I have a file, right? And the file is labeled SDT, Short Divrei Torah. And I have an SDT Breishit, an SDT Noah, and an SDT Lech Lecha, and one for most parashiot, you know. So I have an SDT Va'era. From this past week's portion. So what did I do? I sat down for 5 minutes. And I wrote down Rabbi Aaron's son's Torah. Because it's a great Torah, it's a great thought. And then so now it's in my computer. So next year, or whatever it is that I get back to it, it's there. But see, if I don't do that, then I've lost it. So I took that Torah in vain. I didn't do with it what I could do with it. I did something with it, but I didn't do enough with it. So that's true for a thought. So imagine how that's true for a life. Do we take ourselves seriously? Or do we take our lives in vain? We have such potential. And there's so much we can do. You know, and I meet people, they say, well, you know, I don't know what I want to do. Because, you know, my mother wants me to be a doctor, my father wants me to be a lawyer, and I don't know what I want to do, etc. You don't know what you want to do. Okay? It's a good question. You know, I was very lucky. I knew for a long time ago I wanted to do. And thank God, God's been good to me and I got to do it. But there's so much you can do before you know what you want to do. You can do chesed, you can do kindness, you can do wonderful things. You can call up your parent and say hello. You know, there's this book. Oh, what a book. Chicken Soup Stories for the Soul. And then there's another one, More Chicken Soup Stories for the Soul. So just the name of that book, you know, whenever my wife and I, we have a thing. When we used to go to America in the summer. So last summer we didn't go because the baby was born, and this summer we're probably not going to go because Israelite was born. But you know, we used to go to this camp, and we used to teach, and we used to make a habit of taking a day off in the summer when I was teaching, and taking the kids and going to wherever. And part of that day off, you know, we'd go to see a movie. My wife would pick the movie. I'm not big on, like, you know, it's not that I never watch TV, but I like to go and spend time, like, have time with your family and to go and actually sit in the theater and not talk to each other. That didn't make sense to me. But on the other hand, you know, if you go to a good movie, it could be great discussion, whatever. So we've seen some great movies. So my wife, you know, used to say, listen, once a summer I want to go to a movie. So she would always pick the movie. I remember one summer she picked the movie, you know, I heard the name of the movie. I'm thinking, like, you sure you want to see this movie, right? Forrest Gump. Great movie. Unbelievable movie, right? Two summers ago, we saw a magnificent movie. I totally disagreed with the theme. Clint Eastwood and Meryl Streep. What's it called? Bridges Over Madison County, right? Okay. But a powerful movie. Magnificent movie, right? And then part of the day, we would go to a mall. And whenever we go to the mall, so, you know, she does her thing and I do my thing, right? And, you know, we go to this place, we go to that place, whatever. So we walk into a bookstore. So she goes right for the section on art and home decorating, whatever. She's really interested in that stuff. And I go right for, like, the theology and philosophy and whatever. So I go and I'm looking, this is like 2 years ago, and I see this book, Chicken Soup Stories for the Soul. How could you not pick up a book like that, right? What a book. Unbelievable book. Unbelievable book. And I remember there was this one story in there. I don't remember all the details, but you can read the whole book. It'll be worth your while to find the story. And this guy is saying that he heard this speaker, I don't know if it's the author of the book or someone else, speaking about how you have to take action on your feelings, and you have to put them into practice, and you have to find, you know, the people in your life, and you have to tell them I love you. You have to tell them I love you. And that all of us have people in our lives that it's difficult. It's not always easy to say I love you. In fact, one of the essences of tefillah, of prayer, is it's hard. You know, I don't know, torture an eight-year-old. Torture an eight-year-old, you won't get him to say I'm sorry. And you won't get him to say I love you, it's hard. Right? So practice on God. That's what tefillah says. After Tashem Elokecha, practice on God. If you get used to saying I love you, then it becomes easy to say I love you. So I practice with my children. I get them used to saying I'm sorry. So my daughter comes to me and says, you know, Yonatan doesn't mean it when he says I'm sorry. He just knows that if he says I'm sorry, then you stop getting on his case. So I said, okay, you do the same thing. You don't have to mean it. Just say I'm sorry, you don't have to mean it. Because I know that if they get used to saying I'm sorry, it'll be easier for them to say I'm sorry when they're older, when it's important. Okay. So this is what this guy says. And he was thinking about this, and he was really on his mind, whatever, and he decided, you know, he had his father, and he hadn't spoken to his father in a few years, and they had some big argument, and, you know, he couldn't bring himself to call him, and he avoided holidays, and on the occasions where he would go over to the house, and he would see him, they would barely talk, whatever, and he started to realize, you know, here I have this person, my father, this relationship, and nothing. And he resolved to do something about it. And he thought to himself, I can't do this on the phone. I can call him on the phone, and, you know, tell my dad I love you, like, you know, right? I can't do that. So he decided he was going to go over to the house. He didn't know what would be, but he wanted to go over to the house. He just felt this need to sort of resolve this and find closure. And he goes to the house, and he was almost chicken out. He was thinking this is stupid, whatever. And he decided that, you know, if his mother answered the door and she would say, well, what are you doing here? He wouldn't even know what to say. So he knocks on the door, and it's like 8 o'clock in the evening, and his father answers the door. And the look of surprise registers on his father's face. And this is a grown person, this person who's coming to the door. I mean, he's obviously 40s, whatever. And the unasked question, what are you doing here? And he almost loses his nerve. But he takes a step in. And he grabs his father. And he gives him a big bear hug. And he says, I just wanted to tell you I love you. And he takes a step back. And his father looks at him in complete shock. And he sees tears coming out of his father's eye. And the two of them stand there for he doesn't know how long. And his father takes a step forward and he gives him a hug. He says he can't remember the last time his father gave him a hug. And that's it. And he goes home. He says it was an incredibly powerful experience. And you can imagine that the relationship developed from there. Do you take your father in vain? Do you take your ability to say I love you in vain? Do you take your ability to affect your environment in vain? Do you take the impression of who you are and how important and how powerful and how valuable it is for those around you in vain? That's not just tangential. That's essential. And that's a part of what Judaism is. It's a part of the beauty of who we can be and who we are. And that's why this is the third commandment. Kiddush Hashem, to sanctify God's name, means that in everything I do, see, you're never standing still. You're always moving forward or you're moving backwards. In everything. I met this guy. This guy came in here the other night. Seems like a wonderful fellow. And, you know, sometimes somebody meant, like you ask somebody, what do they do? And sometimes somebody just say, oh, I'm a lawyer. I'm a this. Sometimes people have, answers which require a conversation. You know, I remember a lady came in here once. I'm a psychic healer. Okay. Really? That's nice. I'm a rabbi. It's nice to meet you. You know, somebody says something. This guy says, well, I run a dojo. I don't even know what the name was. Mugu, Yayo, whatever, right? And I teach people Torah through the martial arts. Wow. Okay. Brace it, Barai. Look, you're a great idea, right? Wow! Great idea. So we started a discussion that we couldn't finish. I said, you gotta come by. I want to hear about this. This is so interesting. So interesting. So I was talking to him about the martial arts. I was into it for a while when I was younger. And you're never standing still. I remember for a while I was teaching and these white belts would come to class and they would be amazed that they actually were, that there was a name for them. Like the first day you start karate or jujitsu or whatever, you're a white belt, right? So you get your belt. It's very easy. You don't have to earn it much. You just have to come, right? Getting your next belt, your yellow and your green and your purple and your brown and your black, that's a little more difficult. So you teach a white belt, whatever you teach them. You know, these guys come, they're all excited, right? I mean, they're going to come into class, men and women, right? And people come from different perceptions. And I always used to ask, you know, why are you here? What are you looking for? Etc. And you always get your one guy who comes in, you know, and he wants to learn the move. You know, he came in for 2 hours on a Monday evening. He wants to leave being able to fly through the air. You know, whoa, right? He's like looking for the boards. Where do I break them? You know, like he's all ready. And he's got it down. I mean, he knows how to do it. All he has to do is go, whoa, right? That's it, right? He's got it down. He's seen enough movies. So you say to him, okay, you know, we want to start you off. First, we're going to teach you horse stance, right? And you look at this guy and you say, well, you know, you got to put your feet just right and you have to, you know, tuck yourself in and square your body and your knees have to be over your toes and they have to be faced perfectly and this is how you breathe. No, you're breathing all wrong, whatever. And you have to put your fists in just a certain way. Oh, no, that's not how you make a fist. You have to make it just right. You have to put them just here and your elbows have to be square, whatever. And this guy is like, you know, and he's falling over and he's doing it all wrong, whatever. And he's like, no, breathe right. You know, and you go over, you slap his tuchus, no, move it in, whatever. And he's doing this for 20 minutes. So you have to practice this, but I'll give you something else to practice, right? Say, well, you know, you can practice a punch. He says, oh, sure, you know, no, that's not how you do it. You know, you have to put one hand out, you have to put the other hand, and you have to do it really slowly. And you have to develop that they're just turning in the middle, and this action reaction has to do with your breathing. And as your breath is coming out, it's coming in, and as your breath is going in, it's going out, and just at the end, you have to turn it around, right? And this is what you have to do. And the whole week, I want you to practice this. And the guy walks out of class completely bewildered. He's like, what did I learn how to do? I learned how to punch the head of the horse that I'm riding. What is that? You know, I wanted to, right? Of course, he doesn't realize that from horse stance is back stance, and from back stance is cat stance, and every stance starts from horse stance, and all this different stuff. But he doesn't know that. Now, the next week, this guy is going to come back. And I will take one look at him, and I'll know whether he practiced. And two white belts will come, and you can tell which one practiced and which one didn't. Now, black belt didn't practice that week. You can't tell. But he can tell. Because if he's not practicing, then instead of moving forward, he's moving backwards. And that's true with everything. So maybe a person who comes to Torah and they've never studied Torah before, if they put in an hour a day of Torah study, the difference by the end of the week is incredible. And maybe some people, I don't know, Rabbi Cardozo, so if he doesn't learn on a given day, you might not notice the difference, but he notices the difference. If I go a day without learning, I notice the difference, I see the difference. I had a Rebbe used to say, a teacher used to say, he used to walk around in the Beit Midrash, in the house of study, in the yeshiva where I was learning. He used to say, I can tell whether you davened this morning. I can tell whether you prayed. And I can tell whether you had a good prayer service. Because I see it on you. Because it affects your learning. Because it moves you to a certain direction and there's a difference. And that's what this is about. Is it does it have purpose or does it not? Are you moving forward? Or are you standing still? Because you can't stand still. And that, by the way, you should know is the biggest challenge. And I'll tell you one last thought. Because people think, I want to run. I don't want to walk. I want to run. I want to ride. I want to move. I'm all excited. You know? Get me the book, the 613. I'm going to take them all. It's not such a simple thing. And very often, if you start running, you know, you ever watch one of the most special moments? I missed this with my daughter. I was in an unfortunate reserve day. I caught it with my son. That first step. Wow, what a moment. I mean, your kid is like crawling around, and he's like, first he kind of like stands and falls over in his tuchus, right? And you know, you run to get the camera and the video, and you're playing around with him, and you're trying to get him to do it, right? And he tries to step, and he falls on his face. And then that day comes, and he takes a step. And he takes another step. He doesn't understand what the heck the big deal is, right? You know, he's just putting his foot forward. You know, he has to pee. He has to take a step. That's life, right? But you're going bananas, and you call your mother, and you call your grandmother, and you call her mother, and his mother, and the uncles, and the aunts. And everybody says, especially, you know, my daughter, so she's the first child, and the first grandchild, and the first great-grandchild, right? She's the princesca, right? You know what I mean? So, what a thing. A step. Now, the most interesting thing is when the kid realizes he can walk, and he starts to want to run. That's a disaster. That's a real disaster. First, you have to get walking down. And people sometimes leave, I don't know, they leave Israelite. And if you're excited and you want to take something on, it's very important to take it a step at a time. To do some walking. And I'll give you a classic example. There's a Psikta Rabati, which is a group of Medrash. Each school of thought, each Beit Midrash, as it were, house of study, put out a different work of Medrash, more or less, in the Tannaitic period. And that's what we call Medrash. And I've been quoting to you from the Medrash Rabbah, from which was a particular school. So this is a different one. It's called Psikta Rabati, whatever. So there's a beautiful Medrash. And it talks about this commandment. And says, what's the value of this commandment? Lo tisat shem Hashem alokecha lashav. Don't carry the name of God in vain. Don't make yourself out to be carrying the name of God if it's really vain. Now that's very interesting. And it gives an example. It gives a mashal, an allegory, incredible example. It says there was a man. And the man came into a community just at the eve of Shabbat. And he has all this money. He doesn't know what to do with this money. So he walks into the synagogue. He figures, where's the safest place to put your money? Go to the synagogue. And he sees a guy and he's wearing tefillin. Now it used to be that the biblical injunction really is to wear tefillin all day. To wear the phylacteries all day, not just in the morning. But at a certain point, we weren't on the level. You know, if you wear tefillin, you have to be on a certain level. I actually know somebody who, whenever he sits and learns, he wears tefillin all day. And he says he's doing it because it forces him to remember, you know, when you wear tefillin, I'm very careful what I say when I wear tefillin. You're not supposed to speak slander, and you're not supposed to have thoughts, and all sorts of different things, right? The halacha is, even if you pass wind, if you want to pass wind, you take your tefillin off. Because you're wearing tefillin. You're wearing the name of God. You're wearing a Torah, so a mini Torah scroll, fine. So there was a certain point in history where we just weren't on the level to wear tefillin all day. But even when you wore tefillin all day, you didn't wear them right up until the Shabbat. So he walks into the synagogue and he sees this guy wearing tefillin. And it's only a little while before Shabbat. He figures, oh wow, this guy, first of all, he's in the synagogue. He's wearing tefillin. And he's even wearing tefillin this late in the afternoon. Psh, this is the guy to leave my money with. He says, listen, I have money, whatever, etc. You know, can you watch it for me? He says, sure, no problem. Takes the money. So Saturday night, he comes to this guy. You can guess the ending of the story. The guy says, excuse me? I'm sorry, but I'm busy studying Talmud. I don't know who you are. This guy has a freak attack. So now, remember, this is an allegory, right? So if it's a medrash, if it's an allegory, then anything can happen. So Elijah comes to this guy in a dream that night. You know, if you're going to have a dream, right? So Elijah comes to him in a dream. And Elijah says to him, listen, go to this guy's wife and tell her the secret password that they use. They have a secret password. And whenever he has to send a message to her or whatever, they have a password that they use. So that she'll know that he's the one who's really sending you. What's the password? Right? On Passover, we eat leaven. And on Yom Kippur, we eat food. We eat bread. Right? It's a bit of a strange password, but okay. So he goes and he meets the wife. And he tells her this password. On Passover, we eat leaven, right? Chametz, you're not supposed to eat. And on Yom Kippur, we eat bread, right? Obviously, he's supposed to fast, whatever. And she says, oh, you must be coming from my oven. So he says, yeah, he asked me to get that collection of money that he came home with Friday afternoon. So she gives him the money and he goes away. Her husband comes home. He has a freak attack. And he beats his wife. That's the story. What does that mean? So what it means is that this guy is wearing the tefillin, but he's not wearing the tefillin. See, if you're wearing the tefillin, but you're not wearing the tefillin, then you're not really wearing the tefillin. Now, why does the story choose tefillin? Because tefillin is an oath. It's called in the Bible an oath. It's a sign. It's very visible. And it's a clear indication. It's supposed to be of who you are. But if you're using the indicator without understanding what it's supposed to indicate, then you've missed the boat. How many people wear the right clothes, but they're not wearing the right heart? How many people start from the outside and work their way in instead of starting from the inside and working their way out? Now don't get me wrong. God forbid that anybody should walk out of this class and think that we have the right to judge anybody. This doesn't mean you walk out in the street and say, oh, hat, huh? So what's in there, buddy? Right? That's not the point. The point is that for each of us, we have to be sure we're doing it right. Because too often, when people begin to discover Judaism and the beauty of Judaism, they want to take the externals. And externals are very important. And they signify a lot. You learn a lot about a person from what's outside. And that can be good and it can be not good. It can be very dangerous. But it's legitimate. But at the same time, we as individuals have to be sure that we're developing our inside and not just our outside. And that, I think, is very much a part of Lo Tisa Hashem Hashem Elokecha Lashav. You carry an awesome responsibility. You carry a gift, a beauty. And that's why this guy comes home and beats his wife. Because she's his wife in name. They don't have a real relationship. It's not what's inside. The real relationship of a husband and wife, no one ever knows about. Because it's behind closed doors. It's between you and her. And there's no big challenge to have the right relationship when you're at dinner with friends. The real challenge is, do you have that relationship when it's just the two of you? Do you, you know, and it can be a function of so many different things. It could be the little things that you do, you know, the little chocolate bar you leave on the pillow, whatever it might be. The fact that you're willing to clean the toilet bowl. All the little things that you give, that you are who you are. And if that's true for a relationship with a wife, it's true for a relationship with a child, and a parent, and a teacher, and a friend. It's no big deal that when your friend has a birthday and everybody's going out, that you're the buddy. But are you there for the friend when the friend really needs you? When the friend wants to unload their heart and you don't have time for it? When the friend looks down and you know it, but you're in a different direction? If we develop our ability not to take God's name and all that it means within us and around us in vain, then we become better people. And that's the ethical perception of a mitzvah. And the implications of it, the far-reaching effects of it, are incredible. And I'll tell you one last story and we'll stop. The same book, Chicken Soup Stories for the Soul. There's a story in there. Whenever I think of that book, this story just hangs in my mind until I tell it. So if you heard it before, maybe now you'll remember it enough to tell it to somebody else. Mahatma Gandhi is getting on a train. Now you know, I assume, who Mahatma Gandhi was. Incredible individual. And he really changed the face of an entire destiny of an entire nation. And he taught the world something very, very valuable, which was passive nonviolence. And if you really study, because I became fascinated with him, if you really study him, so he was like all human beings, not perfect. But nonetheless, there was tremendous beauty in his philosophy. So he, during the course of his revolt, his passive revolt against the British Empire and freedom and rights, equal rights, whatever that means, for Indians, etc. So he was going on different speaking tours, and he was getting on a train to speak at some destination. Now in India, you get on a train, it's not like, you know, in New York, you get on a train, it's an hour train ride. You know, you could be going on a 10-day train ride, especially in those days. So he's getting on this train, and as he's getting on the train, you know, partially because he was an Indian, and this was part of what he was fighting against, so the train wasn't going to stop at the platform at this particular stop. There were apparently nobody of stature that it was worthwhile for the train to stop. The train would slow down, and you would have to run alongside the train and jump on. And you could imagine what this was like if you wanted to send your, you know, your elderly mother to her cousin. So men would literally carry the elderly mother, they would run along the train, throw her in the train. So it sounds like an insignificant thing, but it was part of the struggle that they were having. So he was running alongside this train, and he jumped on the train with a few of his students, and one of his shoes fell off. And he reached for it, and he couldn't grab it. Now you have to understand, in those days, I mean, you know, it wasn't like, okay, I'll get there, I'll go to Kmart. So what did he do? He immediately grabbed his other shoe and threw it off. So the student said, what's the matter with you? He said, what do you mean? Some poor guy's going to walk along the tracks. So now instead of finding one shoe, he'll find two. Now that's a Kiddush Hashem. That's a sanctification of God's name. You understand that? That's tremendous. To have the, I mean, because 2 minutes later he would have thought of it, it would have been meaningless. Because no poor man's going to walk along the tracks for 2 hours to find the other shoe. So you have to have that in you. It has to be so much a part of you that it's a natural reaction. That's what you're looking for. That's what it means, Lo Tisad Shem Hashem Elokecha Lashav. The potential of who you are and what you can do. And how you can affect. And I want you to know, I don't know if Mahatma Gandhi knew when he did that, that someone was going to put it in a book, and that millions and millions of people were going to read it and become inspired.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.